Today's episode is brought to you by Malwarebytes Premium. Protect your computers and devices from cyber attacks 24/7 with Malwarebytes Premium. And go to malwarebytes.com/lock and code for an exclusive offer. That's malwarebytes.com/lock and code.
This is where the argument around smartphones and social media being behind the adolescent mental health crisis actually has kind of paradoxically some optimism to it. Because if that's the cause, that means we can do something about it.
This is Lock and Code, a Malwarebytes podcast. I'm your host, David Reese. Our main story today is about a potential crisis amongst our youth. In the summer of 2022, while writing a still upcoming book about how smartphones and social media have allegedly, quote, rewired many societies, end quote, in alarming and harmful ways, the social psychologist and author, Jonathan Haidt, realized that he had a problem. His planned first chapter about the impact of smartphones and social media on children and teens specifically couldn't be just one chapter. It would need to be an entire book of its own. According to the American College Health Association, the percentage of undergraduates in the U.S., so mainly young adults in college, who were diagnosed with anxiety increased 134% since 2010. In the same time period, for the same group, there was an increase in diagnoses of depression by 106%, ADHD by 72%, bipolar by 57%, and anorexia by 100%. According to another study, the U.S. National Survey on Drug Use and Health, the prevalence of anxiety, again, in America increased for every age group except those over 50, again, since 2010. So that means that people who are aged between 35 and 49 experienced a 52% increase. Those aged between 26 and 34 experienced a 103% increase. And for even younger fellows between 18 and 25, they experienced a 139% increase. As Haidt wrote after presenting a snippet of that data on his own website, quote, "What happened to young people in the early 2010s," end quote. And while it's disingenuous to ever distill an entire work into just a few words, the answer to Haidt's question, which is the thesis of his latest book, is clear. What happened to young people in the early 2010s was the prevalence of smartphones and social media. Haidt's book, The Anxious Generation: How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness, posits that today's children are increasingly subject to a phone-based childhood and increasingly deprived of a play-based childhood. That, Haidt argues, is where much of the blame can be laid for increased rates of anxiety, depression, suicidality, and more. And rather than just naming the problem, Haidt also proposes 5 solutions to turn things around. 1, give children far more time playing with other children. 2, look for more ways to embed children in stable, real-world communities. 3, don't give a smartphone as the first phone. 4, don't give a smartphone until high school. And 5, delay the opening of accounts on nearly all social media platforms until the beginning of high school, at least. I want to step back and quickly say that, even to me, these proposals feel right. I have personally felt better when I've taken social media sabbaticals, and I have personally felt worse when I've stayed awake too long scrolling through my phone. Yes. But there are 2 important caveats here. And one is that I don't have kids and I don't have a background in social psychology. So how the hell am I qualified to endorse Haidt's proposals as correct or effective? And 2, and perhaps more substantively, is that some qualified people do not agree with Haidt. Writing for the outlet Platformer, reporter Zoe Schiffer spoke with multiple behavioral psychologists who allege that Haidt's book cherry-picks survey data. It ignores mental health crises that are also happening amongst adults, and it oversimplifies a complex problem with a blunt solution. Which is why we're going to try and get some clarity on this issue with someone else who is deeply versed in generational research and our collective use of technology. Today, to help us understand the mental health crisis affecting today's youth, the data on how smartphones and social media perhaps contribute to that crisis, and whether putting heavier restrictions on smartphones could truly help, we're speaking with Dr. Jean Twenge, professor of psychology at San Diego State University and author of several books, including Generations, which lays bare the real differences between baby boomers, Gen Xers, millennials, and Gen Z, and iGen, an early look into Gen Z's attitudes and behaviors. Jean, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
We are thrilled to have you on today's show. I feel like there are a million things to get into, so we just kind of have to race right into them, right? And so after that very long intro, I want to start again with Haidt's book, right? The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. And before we get into all like the phone restrictions, the social media restrictions, like the proposals, right? The tech proposals, I actually just kind of want to start with the title there, that claim of a mental health epidemic. You've studied generations for decades. From your research, is there a mental illness epidemic? And if so, like, what is it? What does that mean?
Yeah, there absolutely is. So my expertise is in looking at big national surveys. That's what I work with most of the time. A lot of those are on teenagers. And my history with this goes back quite a while, because as I was working on iGen, which came out in 2017, I was really taking a deep dive into what teens say about themselves, about how they spend their time, about what's important to them, about how they're feeling. And in the data coming out, you know, for 2012 or so, there started to be an increase in teens saying they felt left out, saying they felt lonely, saying they felt like they couldn't do anything right, that their life wasn't useful. Those last two are classic symptoms of depression. First, I thought it was a blip, but then 2013, 2014, these increases kept going. Then more and more data started to appear that clinical level depression doubled between 2011 and 2019. All the statistics that you mentioned and more, including behaviors, things like self-harm, emergency room admissions for self-harm behaviors have doubled among 15 to 19-year-old girls and have more than quadrupled among 10 to 14-year-old girls. So it's across the board. It's not just diagnoses. It's also self-reports on surveys of people. That's a cross-section where they may have sought help, they may not have sought help. That's the prevalence in the whole population. So we know it's not over diagnosis. We know it's not just people being more willing to admit to problems, because we also see these changes in behaviors. And they're big changes. And they take place very suddenly in the early 2010s, with the end result being often doubling, tripling, quadrupling of these very, very serious issues. And it's pre-concentrated among teens and young adults. So yeah, there is also an uptick in depression among 26 to 34-year-olds who are now, especially those in their early 30s, that's going to be millennials. But that increase in depression is only about a third of the size of the younger adults and the teens. And for a lot of other indicators, we're just seeing very little for increases for those over 35 or especially 40 years old. It's really concentrated among the younger population. And I think it is not at all an exaggeration to call it a crisis, given how fast those numbers increased over such a short period of time.
You said there that there was a sudden increase suddenly in the 2010s. Have we ever seen a similar sudden bump in such a short amount of time from what you've seen?
Not one that is this large.
Yeah.
So in one of the data sets, for example, you'd expect maybe the Great Recession to have a big impact.
Exactly.
But it didn't. There is a little bit of an uptick in poor mental health in this data set around 2008, but it's pretty small and it goes away fairly quickly. And these trends are the opposite. They're very large and they kept building. They didn't go away. They weren't something that happened over a course of a few years and then faded, they kept building.
And when we look also at prior generations, when they were teens, there isn't this type of loneliness spike or anxiety spike, correct? So when I was a teen, I think a lot of people might assume, well, you're a teenager, you're going to feel this way no matter what, right? But I'm trying to get a baseline here and understand, okay, baby boomers, Gen X, millennials, comparatively didn't show the same rates as when they were teens. Is that correct?
So yes, what we're doing is comparing people of the same age at different points in time in nationally representative samples. So what we know there is that it's not age. It's not just being 15 or 16 years old that's causing this. Because if that were the case, then you wouldn't see any change over time. It'd be the same for people of that age, you know, across the years. That said, not all of this data goes back far enough for us to get a completely 100% clear picture of what it looked like for Gen Xers and boomers at the same age. So it depends on which measure we're looking at. So we pretty much have millennials covered. We have most of Gen X covered for rates of depressive symptoms and loneliness. And so there we can compare all the way back and say, yes, this is very unusual that Gen Xers didn't look like this at that age. For, say, clinical level depression, major depression, we don't have the data going back that far using the same measure and the same sampling. So we have to try to rely on other things. What you do see is that millennials as teens, pretty happy. They're not showing high levels of loneliness compared to Gen Z. For Gen X, we don't see the loneliness. We don't see the depressive symptoms. We do see more unhappiness among Gen X at the same age compared, say at 18 or 17, compared to millennials. There was also a very high suicide rate for Gen X teens in the late 80s and early 90s. So that's one piece that many people are pointing to as saying, well, that's why I'm not so sure this thing with Gen Z is unusual. Well, there's a couple of points that are important to keep in mind here. So one is those Gen Z rates in 2018 actually did exceed those Gen X rates earlier from the 80s and 90s. So yes, it did reach that rate, which is unfortunate. The other piece is, of course, when you think about cultural change, there's many, many different causes. And we have to keep in mind what the environment was like, particularly in the early 90s. That was a time when violent crime rates were at all-time highs that have not been equaled since. And there was a huge availability of cheap guns. So in Generations, my most recent book, I dug into this in the Gen X chapter to try to see what this really looked like. And it turns out that the suicide rate for teens who were Gen Xers at the time did not spike if you look at suicides that did not involve guns. So suicides without firearms, it's pretty flat. It's those that involved guns, and it mimics the homicide rate at the same time. So it was just that period of time in the early 90s when violent crime was very, very high, and there was a lot of cheap guns around. Homicide and suicide were both very high for Gen X teens and young adults. I always tell people, if you want to see like a little bit of a window on that time, watch the first season of the TV show ER. And you get a view of that, the grittiness of that, you know, all the horrible stuff happening at that time. Because what's remarkable about the trend for Gen Z is that was happening at a time when a lot of those indicators for teens were much better. Violent crime was a lot lower. Teenage pregnancy was a lot lower. Families were more stable during the 2010s than they were in the late 80s, early 90s. So there's all these things that happened during that Gen X time, which push in that direction, plus the availability of firearms. And none of those things are present for Gen Z. Like, they should be happier. They should be better adjusted. The suicide rate should be lower given all these other indicators.
I feel like this next question, it's a one-word question. I feel like it's something that you work on, that everyone works on who studies this and you've been racking your brains about this. But like you said, the indicators aren't there in the same way that they were for Gen X, that you see a sudden spike in 2012. All this is to say, why? Like, what is it? We're getting to the heart of it, right? Like, what is happening?
That was the question I had when I first started to see these trends show up. You know, there's like often an 18-month delay. So, you know, that data coming out in 2012, 2013, you know, it's like 2015, 2016 when I'm starting to see these upticks. And I had no idea. It was a complete mystery because it did not line up with the Great Recession. There would have to have been like a four-year delay in the response because very little happened in these indicators of loneliness and depressive symptoms, the first ones that I was looking at during that time. They really didn't change much for teens during that time. U.S. economy was finally improving around 2012. It was finally starting to get better. So it was pretty clear that wasn't it. And then trying to think of any event that happened that then kept going. I couldn't think of anything. So I puzzled over this for a really, really long time over that time period, 2015, 2016. Then I thought, well, you know, I'm looking at these other aspects of teens' lives in the rest of this data set. They're spending less time with their friends in person. And it looks like they're sleeping less too. Maybe that has something to do with it. But that still begs the question, well, why is that happening? Then I saw a poll from the Pew Center. Things started to fall into place a little bit. It showed that the end of 2012 was the first time that the majority of Americans owned a smartphone. Then in the data sets that I work with, daily social media use started to cross kind of a critical level at around that time, where about 3/4 of teens were using it. In other words, then you were left out if you didn't use it, as opposed to when it's 50%, which is what it was in 2009. Oh, you can either use it or not. Some people do, some people don't. But then it hits that kind of tipping point, especially in a high school population where, you know, fitting in is important. Then turns out that's also around the same time that phones got front-facing cameras, that Facebook bought Instagram, that algorithms on social media started to become more sophisticated. All this is happening around that same time. And then those after effects of teens are spending less time with each other in person. They're spending less time sleeping. Those are things that technology also interferes with. And I realized this makes sense because not only are these things happening at the same time, that's only step one. It's that it completely changed the way teens spent their time outside of school. It's unrecognizable for Gen Xers with their Gen Z kids. Their teenage years are completely different because of those factors. They're not going out with their friends and hanging out with their friends. Instead, they're in their bedrooms alone scrolling through Instagram.
I am glad that you put together like that it's not that in 2012 the smartphone was invented, right? Because it's not that, right? It's more so that 2012 is this landmark year for what it sounds is like a sort of creeping giant, you know, really waking up that the majority of people have cell phones, that social media daily usage is overtaking, it's becoming the norm. And it's like you said, for high schoolers in particular, it's popular. Like, it's that simple. Like, you have to be engaged. You have to be plugged in that way. And that even simple thing, like, I had forgotten that, you know, Facebook bought Instagram in 2012. I remember that. And manipulations with an algorithm really start to get supercharged. All that is to say, like, oh, that makes so much sense. I had also had sort of the same questions myself. Like, well, the iPhone is older than that, but it's sort of a mass adoption. I wanted to ask, because these are things that feel like, yeah, those fit into place. This all starts to fit into place. The puzzle starts becoming clear. Do we have data that traces these rates of depression and suicidality and self-harm, like all of these issues that are happening with young people in particular? Do we have data that traces it directly to phones? Is there something like that exists? Or is it just that these two things are happening concurrently and so it's the most obvious bridge?
Well, I mean, if you're looking at that group level data, I mean, the gold standard would be to do a random assignment experiment, but you can't randomly assign people to be born at different times. You know, you can't do that. It's not possible. Even if you had a time machine, it probably wouldn't be ethical. Like, it's just...
There's bigger problems.
It's not in the cards. That's important because it's not just what's happening to individuals. It's the whole social norm shifting. Take a teen who says, I'm going to live like it's 1988. Who are they going to go out with when the social norm has shifted for that's not the norm anymore? So you have to think of this at the group level and not just the individual one. That's just the reality of looking at these group level and generational level effects. Now, at the individual level, sure, you can do that. And there's several researchers who have done that. randomly assigning people to either continue their normal social media use or to cut back or give up social media for a period of time. And especially those who follow people for 2 weeks or more, they tend to find that the people who cut back or give up on social media are happier and less depressed at the end of that time.
I've done it. It feels correct. Sometimes when we see things like this and they immediately make sense, there's a part of me that, through no ill will, is almost skeptical, is almost like, no, it can't be that easy. But that also might be because I use my phone every day, right? And so there might be some like defense mechanism that's happening where, oh, it can't be that simple because what is it doing to me? I wonder, have you run into that? Have you run into just folks who keep throwing, oh, it's this, oh, it's this, oh, it's this.
And, oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know what? That's good. That's exactly what we need to do to be able to test this thesis, is we need alternative explanations and to see if they fit the data. The thing is, they don't. So I did a Substack post a couple months ago looking at 13 alternative explanations, pretty much everything I had heard in the course of 6 or 7 years since iGen came out in 2017 as an alternative explanation. And none of them fit. I mean, the only one that comes even close is how teens are not as independent now as they used to be. Mm. And so that one half fits. It doesn't fully fit because that trend started in the 90s, not in 2012. So it's been building for a while. But I do think that there is a possibility that these things go hand in hand. I think they work together. They're not opposing forces. That, well, why are teens less likely now to get their driver's license and drink alcohol? Well, that's partially because of something called the slow life strategy. So this is one of the main topics in Generations, that people take longer to grow up and to grow old. And it's not all bad or good. It just is. It's what happens when we live longer and when education takes longer. And that's what happens in a more technologically advanced society. You know, the idea of you're a true full-fledged adult at age 18, it's just not that way anymore because of economic pressures as well as just needing more education and needing more guidance. But it's also the same reason that 50 is the new 40 and 60 is the new 50,
yeah.
That we have longer lives. But there are definitely trade-offs for teens, that there's some great things. You know, most parents and public health experts are pretty thrilled that not as many teens are having sex and drinking alcohol. But then you look at kids and realize, well, they're also not going out. They're not dating. They're not working at jobs. They're not getting their driver's license. Then what happens when they go off to college or the workplace and they have to make decisions for themselves? So that's where some of the challenges come in. And that also may be a piece. I don't think it's the piece, but maybe part of some of the mental health crisis is, especially once you hit young adulthood, whoa, what do I do now? Because I haven't been out of the house without my parents all that much. I've never had a driver's license or a job. And now I'm in these situations, maybe even being away from home for the first time, and I've got to try to figure this out. And so some of what goes on, especially maybe with college undergraduates, might be partially due to that lack of independence during the teen years. And that's also a really important piece, because we have to realize, if we're going to make some of these changes around smartphones and social media, what are we going to replace it with? We have to replace it with something. We can't say just sit and stare at the wall. How about going out with your friends, getting the driver's license, maybe getting a job or doing some volunteer work? Getting out there in the real world, having some of those experiences might be beneficial.
I have asked kind of around this question, but I wanted to drill down into it because I know you've especially done, like you said, comparative analyses. And so I want to say that you and Height both agree that smartphones have significantly impacted, right, our youngest generations. I wanted to just understand, like, what are, to you, the most alarming differences you've found between Gen Z and prior generations? And how do those differences, can they be traced to the use of smartphones?
So I think the mental health crisis and some of its downstream effects are the most alarming. You know, we've been discussing those rates of clinical depression, of anxiety, of self-harm, of suicide being so high. It is a crisis. Young people are suffering. We have to pay attention to that. And related to that, try to figure out what's causing it. And, you know, this is where the argument around smartphones and social media being behind the adolescent mental health crisis actually has kind of paradoxically some optimism to it, Because if that's the cause, that means we can do something about it. Most causes of depression are pretty hard to change. You can't change your genetics. You can't change traumatic experiences in the past. It's in the past. You can learn how to cope with it, but you can't change it. It'd be really difficult to solve poverty and discrimination overnight. But there are some pretty common sense changes that we can make, both as individuals and as a society, to try to not give up technology, but just use it in a more balanced way and to protect our kids from being exposed to these things too early. That is where I have some optimism. Where I do, some of the pieces that I do think are the most alarming is that mental health crisis, but then also, what does that mean for democracy? Because when you're depressed, it's not just about emotions. It's also about cognition and thinking. So if you're seeing the world through this lens, you're going to be more pessimistic. You're going to be less trusting. You're going to have less faith in the institutions around you. That's exactly what has happened. That's exactly what we see with Gen Z. And that's the biggest difference between Gen Z and millennials, when it was millennials who were the young adults. Millennials were optimistic. They're not quite as optimistic anymore. That's another conversation. But they were very optimistic as teens and young adults. That had some downsides, but it has some really big upsides, especially for politics. Gen Z is the opposite. They are very, very pessimistic. They're much more likely to say that they don't have hope. Even in things like, do you think America is a fair society or an unfair society? Among all the generations, and this is at one point, so age could have something to do with it, but young people are supposed to be idealistic and optimistic, and instead it's the opposite. Gen Z young adults are more likely to say America is an unfair society. They're more likely to say that major changes are needed to American government compared to previous generations. So that optimism to pessimism shift, I think, is going to have really big downstream impacts on politics and on the culture. I think we're seeing it already. And it may not be all bad. I mean, if you have pessimism and you think things need to be changed, that can be great. Then you can work toward constructive change. But too often it becomes nihilism and let's just give up. And I think that's the real danger.
I know that we have feared technology in the past, right? We've feared television. We've feared violent video games. Are we not barreling down the same path as we did with earlier fears of technology? How is this different?
I mean, I think there's a couple things here. So first, it's different because smartphones and social media just have such an enormous effect. They've had such an enormous effect on how teens live their lives. I mean, just to take an example, when cable TV became popular in the 80s, there was not the equivalent plummeting of teens getting together with each other in person. Maybe went down by a little bit, but really, compared to what we saw after 2012, nothing. This is a device that, first, social media has algorithms. You know, TV, streaming, try to keep you watching, but they're not like TikTok where they are showing you exactly what you want to see every minute. It's just not as sophisticated. Smartphones can be brought into social situations as well in a way that TV really can't, or at least couldn't before smartphones. Social media is social. It's about how we relate to each other, not just about something we're passively watching like TV. This is all the reasons why it's different. However, I always like to push back a little bit on this argument of, oh, people said TV was going to have this bad effect on society and nothing happened. Well, yeah, actually it did. Right? So, I mean, everybody can think of many examples of the effect that television had on society, some of them good, some of them bad. But just to offer one, Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, which came out in 2000, which is about the collapse of institutions and community groups, it's something like 800 pages long. And at the end of that, the explanation that he hits on is probably the most correct for why this happened is television.
Is it just that everyone stayed home? Like, is it just that we became... Yeah. Okay, there it is.
Yeah, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but yes, you know, that's one of the reasons why there weren't as many bowling leagues, which is one of his examples. Or, I mean, think about the things that people used to do in their evenings or weekends back in the day, you know, the Elks Club, the Kiwanis Club, things like that, that people would get together. And that's one of the things that Putnam traces in his book. And that's just not as attractive when you could stay home and watch television.
Right. Yeah, the death of like the third space, right? Like the place that was neither home nor work. But I love this comparison you made between, you know, the algorithms powering something like TikTok and the algorithms powering something like streaming television, right?
Yeah, like Netflix or something like
right?
that.
Like, I think everyone can understand immediately, like, oh, well, Netflix is doing some stuff to keep me watching, right? But the comparison, I think a really good comparison is, you know, seeing how, I'd say, intelligent, you know, dare I say, intelligent and trained something like TikTok's algorithm is against something like HBO Max, which doesn't know what I watch when I watch it. I can watch an episode of a TV show, and the next time I log in, there's no recommendation of like, would you like to keep watching this show, which you have shown interest in? Absolutely not. It thinks I'm someone else entirely. It's hard to find the very program I watch. It is enjoyably bad. But yes, they are like, the differences in sophistication are immediately obvious. I wanted to close with two like really big picture questions here. And so the first one, right, is just, we've gone through a lot of this. We've gone through a lot of the data. We've looked at it. We're seeing the role that smartphones and social media play with kids, with us as well, right? So if it were up to you, what major policy or even societal shifts, if you could play God, you know, would you introduce to help today's children?
Well, the first would be to raise the age minimum for social media to 16 and actually verify age. So right now, the age minimum is 13 and it's not even enforced. So 9 and 10-year-olds are routinely on TikTok. Routinely. We know this from survey data as well as plenty of anecdote. You know, the platforms say, oh, we take steps. Well, obviously they don't. Because right now, you just have to check a box or choose a different birthday and you're on. Parental permission also not required. So there are 9 and 10-year-olds on TikTok who are not only on there, but their parents have no idea. We could start by just, how about enforcing existing law? That might be nice. However, the problem with the age minimum as it exists now at 13, you know, if you went to a bunch of parents or educators, developmental psychologists, and said, what do you think? Do you think that 13, right during middle school and early puberty, is the best time ever to introduce social media? No one would agree with that. So we trust kids to drive at 16. They're well into high school. Some people say it should be 18 before you can do social media. I think 16 is a nice compromise position. Maybe then if you're getting interested in the world and politics, it could be yet another avenue. And then people say, well, what if they're 15 and interested in that stuff? They have the rest of the internet. It doesn't have to be social media. It can be all of these other sources up to that point that aren't algorithmic, that don't cause body image issues among teen girls and young women, as Meta's own research showed. There's so many other places to find connection, to find information. It doesn't have to be social media. That would be my first on my wish list.
What's next on your wish list? I feel like this could power an hour of conversation, but I am curious. Like, are there more?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
So my next one would be no phones during the school day, bell to bell. That would mean teachers wouldn't have to be the phone police during class. Students would be more focused, less distraction, and they would talk to each other during lunch, during passing period, because a lot of high schools that allow access to phones, lunchrooms are eerily silent. The kids are on their phones, even though they're sitting right next to each other. And so that social interaction, good for mental health, also good for developing social skills. Because that's what I hear from managers when I give talks on generations in the workplace. They'll say, I like Gen Z for a lot of reasons, but I'm surprised at how many will not look me in the eye. And they don't have the social skills that we need them to have. And this was a concern before the pandemic. And then the teens and kids who were isolated during that time, it just brought it even next level. So this is what they need. They need to be talking to each other face to face. And with access to the phones, that's not happening. And schools for learning, those phones are absolutely interfering with learning in the classroom as well.
Yeah. I feel like every teacher would agree with you on that one. I feel like that's like a slam dunk, like policy proposal. Yeah. Like, oh yeah.
It really should be.
Yeah.
It really, really should be. And I think it's just, in some cases, it's logistics that may be in the way, but there's more and more solutions, you know, but it's best for that phone to be physically in a different location and not, or at least not accessible. So some schools have just a big place where everybody sticks their phone, you know, when they get there in the morning. And then others use, there's a company called Yonder that makes these locking pouches. Mm-hmm. They have been used at concerts for stand-up comedians when they just want people to focus or not be filming their routine. And some schools have used those because then the kids actually do have the phone on them, but they can't use it because the pouch is locked. And it unlocks automatically at the end of the day.
Yeah. I wanted to go back to the proposal of like 16-year-olds, you know, as being the earliest age and, you know, actually upholding that. Because I know a lot of people will say, well, what's the difference between 15 and 16, right? Like, what's the difference between a 15-year-old who's 364 days old and a 16-year-old? Mm-hmm. And I also, like, related to that, I wonder if the answer is 16 is just the age that we accept poison. And I feel that way with like 21-year-olds and alcohol, right? Like,
right.
I think we've learned through very recent surveys and data that like alcohol is poison. Like, it's just poison, but we like it. And so we just say in the US that 21 is the age you have to be to ingest poison. And I wonder, is that the same with social media? Like, we're like, well, it's poison, but at 16, you have the right. I mean, you have the right to engage in poison. Is it kind of that? Like, what's happening?
Well, I mean, as you point out, I mean, there's a long history of age gating. That, mm-hmm. you know, why do we trust a 16-year-old to drive and not a 15-year-old right. in most states? Yeah. You know, why is somebody who's 20 not allowed to drink, but a 21-year-old is? Like, all of those things. The other piece here is that the correlation between hours per day spent on social media and depression and life satisfaction is higher at the younger ages. So that's why the age gating piece makes sense here. But it's very similar to the thinking about driving and alcohol.
Yeah. I feel like you've got more policy proposals in you. And two of them have very much mirrored, you know, what Haidt says in his book. Let's keep going. What else helps kids?
You know, some of it is stuff that you can do as an individual. So when I give talks on this, the thing I always say, if you want to take just one thing home from the talk, it should be this one. No phones in the bedroom overnight. And that's not just for teens, that's for everybody, if you can possibly do that. Because we know from tons of research, sleep labs, correlational, longitudinal, experimental, you name it, people do not sleep as well or as long when the phone is on that bedside table, which is where almost everybody keeps it. So put it in a different physical location, like on a charger in the kitchen or downstairs or just somewhere away from the bedrooms after lights off. And what people often say next is, but I have to have my phone in my bedroom because it's my alarm clock. And I say, I have some advice for you. Buy an alarm clock. Put your phone away and get a good night's sleep. So there are some old school solutions to what seems like a new problem, but really isn't.
It's funny, when you said that, I was immediately going through that in my mind. I was like, well, then how am I gonna? And there was that very dumb light bulb moment of like, hey, man. You've had an alarm clock before. You've owned one.
That's
you
right.
You know what they
That's
are.
That's right. Exactly. And look, I mean, you know, if you're afraid of being in that Seinfeld episode where they're like, oh, it's the AM, PM, or the power's going to go out or whatever, yeah. Get two alarm clocks, one of which is battery powered. I actually have a battery powered one that I travel with. And one of my kids is in a bunk bed. And so having something plugged in isn't practical. So she has one too.
You brought up something really good here, which is, you know, things that individuals can do. And that's kind of actually what I wanted to close on, you know, this the second question, which is, right, if the changes that we were talking about don't happen, you know, the 16-year-old age, the no phones in schools from bell to bell, if those changes do not happen, what advice do you have for parents, right, who are navigating today's world, especially after hearing all of this potentially scary information?
I have three adolescent children myself. They're 12, 14, and 17. Mm-hmm. So this is my everyday life, not just my research life, as it turns out. So, I mean, the first thing that I always want to say to parents is you're not alone in this. We're all struggling. And it's hard. Parents have been put in an almost impossible position because you don't need parental permission to open social media. Age isn't verified. Kids have school laptops. You can't put parental controls on that have access to YouTube. This is the bane of my existence. And there's just, it's everywhere, right? And so it's tempting, and I've heard people argue this, just give up. Say, you know what? It's everywhere. We can't do anything. And I strongly disagree with that because I think there are some things that you can use to at least stem the tide. And no, you're not going to protect your kids from absolutely everything, but it doesn't mean you should give up. You know, would you give up if you're like, you know, my kid isn't going to go to bed on time every night, so I'm just going to forget about it entirely? Of course you wouldn't do that. And I see this as similar, that you have to do what you can and do as much as you can, which has to be within reason, because it can't be, I'm going to hover over my kid every second when they're doing their homework to make sure they're doing their homework instead of they're on YouTube. This is why we're in a tough position. But you do have to have the conversation with kids about why this is important. But even adolescents respond to clear rules. So that clear rule of no phones in the bedroom is a great one. The other thing that really helps is to not get your kid a smartphone until as late as you can possibly put it off. So John Hyatt in his book says until high school to get the internet-enabled smartphone. I would go even further. The rule in my house is you get your first internet-enabled smartphone when you get your driver's license.
Oh,
so that means
a reward.
You're 16. It's practical because, in my personal opinion, what is the best app on the smartphone? It's Maps. And very helpful when you first have your driver's license, right? Yeah. So there's that piece of it. At that point, it seems more necessary. And it's tying it to independence in a way that I like as well. But it also just puts it off until you're more ready to handle these things. Because the problem with social media being so accessible is the reason a lot of parents don't know their kids have it is because it's on their phone. It's not even on their laptop or on a computer where they can more easily see it. It's so much easier to hide the phone or to only do social media when your parents like aren't around or whatever. Or most teens, when they're on social media, a lot of them don't even know you can do it on a laptop. It's almost all on the phone. So thus, there are practical things here. Some kids are going to need a phone for one reason or another, whether that's, in our case, the bus stop being a mile away, or them having, a bunch of activities and they may need to get in touch with you. But I think that the temptation is to just hand them your old iPhone. And that's easy, I get it, but that's not the best choice, especially if they're really young, like they're 9 or 10. We don't really want to be doing that, especially if it doesn't have any parental controls on it. Then you're basically handing them complete free access to everything on the internet and social media. And we all know what you can run into in there. Plus, then it's the temptation to spend more and more and more time on that phone. So you can get your kids a flip phone. The other thing that we found has worked really well with our younger two kids are phones that are designed for kids. And a lot of parents don't even know these exist. But here's a couple of examples. Gab, Trumi, Pinwheel. It's just full disclosure, I'm on an advisory board for Trumi. And these are phones where you can call and text, sometimes take pictures, sometimes do a few other apps, but no internet access, no ability to download social media. That's nice too, because let's say you put parental controls on the old iPhone that you gave them. Some teens,
they're smart.
Very enterprising. They will find workarounds.
Yeah, 100%.
Because I've heard about that plenty. These kids' phones, you can't do that. It's just not possible on those phones.
Yeah. I enjoy all of this. I enjoy all of these suggestions. They feel so real. They feel so tangible. They feel so within reach, right? And those are the things that matter. And I just very, very briefly want to say, like you said, Maps is such a useful app. I remember when I got my first smartphone, right? Somewhere like maybe 2009, 2010, and it had Maps on it. And then I just didn't, it just wasn't working. And so I had to go back to printing directions on Google Maps.
Oh my God, MapQuest.
Like on MapQuest. And I remember
I'm old enough to remember MapQuest.
Right?
MapQuest would sometimes tell you to take a left turn off the highway. And you're like, I don't think that's right.
And I remember I picked up my friend and he saw like these folded instructions and he was like, you are in a bad one right now, man. All I say, it is very useful. You don't want just pieces of paper in your car.
Exactly.
Gene, thank you again so much for coming on today's show, for explaining all of this data, and for giving folks at home useful things to start working on immediately should they want to. So again, Gene, thank you for coming on today's show.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
To our listeners, we'll talk to you again in 2 weeks. Until then, stay tuned and stay safe. And remember, you can read all our cybersecurity coverage on Malwarebytes Labs at malwarebytes.com/blog. Finally, our intro music is by Kevin MacLeod from Incompetech.com, and our outro music is by Woa from Unminus.com. Today's show has been edited by our podcast consultant, Eric Johnson, at lightningpod.fm. Thank you, folks.